David Olson and his team does a wonderful job of staffing them and is working diligently with Comcast to get to a favorable outcome for everybody. And thanks to Tim Krell in my office for being my liaison to this project. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, thank you, Mount Hood Cable Regulatory Commission and David and everybody else for working on this franchise. It's a very important franchise for the city, as Alan pointed out, and I hope the negotiations can lead to a successful outcome. Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 1452, please call the vote.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thanks to Mark Greinke, City's Chief Technology Office, and all of our partners in all of the different offices. There's a lot of work going on technology issues. This is an important extension for the INET and ERNIE, and I've learned a lot about those things over the last 2 years, and I'm looking forward to the renewed agreement. Aye.
Fish?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Thanks to Commissioner Fritz for leading the team to bring this forward. Thanks to all the volunteers and staff at Community Cable and to the great team at the Bureau of Technology Services. Appreciate it. Aye. So approved. We'll now take the item number 1449.
Adopt budget adjustment recommendations and the supplemental budget for the fiscal year 2010-11 fall supplemental budget process and make budget adjustments in various funds.
Good morning. I'm Andrew Scott, Financial Planning Manager. We had a previous work session on the fall budget monitoring process, or what we call the bump, on October 29th. So I'm going to give a broad overview today, but I'm not going to go back through the specifics again. I think overall, in terms of this bump, there's some good news in the sense that we ended last year in a better financial position than what we had included in the forecast. But that good news is also...
Andrew, could you once again explain what the fall bump is?
Yeah, thank you. The... three times a year after budget adoption, the council city goes back and adjusts its budgets. We have a fall, winter, and spring budget monitoring process. And so bureaus are able to make different changes that need council approval at that point. Fall bump in particular is where we look back at last year and sort of true up to any ending fund balances in all the funds, including the general fund. So again, the good news here is that the general fund ended in a better financial position than we had forecast. However, I'd say that's all tempered by some caution. We still have some national and global economic uncertainty. Obviously, there are some state and local budget shortfalls that may impact the city. And then we're experiencing overall a weak and somewhat jobless economic recovery. So with that context, this bump, and again, I'll focus a little bit on the general fund, it appropriates an additional $15.2 million of beginning fund balance. Again, that's additional from last year. $5.5 million of that is being used to cover encumbrance carryovers. Those are contracts that city bureaus had entered into by the end of last year and will continue on into this year. We're making $814,000 of restorations to cuts that were made last year related to bureau compensation set-aside amounts. There's also $1.8 million of carryover and new requests in the bump. And then in addition, we're making an adjustment to the utility license fee payments that are being transferred to PBOT, again, sort of part of the overall true-up. The remaining balance of a little bit over $9 million is this bump allocates $465,000 of that to the current year general fund contingency. It allocates an additional $1.5 million into our compensation set aside, and that's targeted to deal with police and fire potential retirements coming up next year. It sets aside $2.4 million as per the city financial policy for infrastructure maintenance projects. And finally, it sets aside $3.9 million for next year's budget, for the FY 2011-12 budget, as a set aside for that. The only changes you're seeing in the ordinance filed today from what we talked about at the work session on October 29th, there's a $285,000 draw from contingency to fund the human trafficking program, and I think there's a resolution later on the agenda for that, but that is included in the bump. And then also $6,000 of program carryover has been added to ONI's appropriation at Commissioner Fritz's request to reflect the full amount of their bureau request.
So that the $285,000 going to the domestic the human trafficking shelter, that's why the contingency, we put it into contingency, we took it out again.
In the same action, right. So we're increasing contingency by $750,000, but then pulling out that $285,000.
Thank you.
And otherwise, the bump is the same as what we had talked about earlier. I'm happy to answer any questions.
No The $2.4 million for infrastructure maintenance and projects. And by the way, thank you. This is very clearly laid out, so I appreciate that very much. So my understanding of the $2.4 million for infrastructure maintenance and projects is that they are for projects that were requested in the budget or not funded. Does that mean that there will be some process for council to review which particular projects are done with that $2.4 million?
I've asked that the Bureau of Financial Planning return, after working with the bureaus, with a list that shows what was selected and what was not for our review.
And what's eligible for that? Is it only infrastructure or is it other requests?
The financial policies note that it's infrastructure maintenance, and then it stresses that priorities given to projects that were requested in the last budget but not funded. Obviously, you know, council gets to make the final decision in terms of where that goes.
So that would be things like things in the transportation capital improvement project maintenance budget that we didn't have enough money for?
This general fund capital set aside can be used for pretty much anything.
Thank you.
That qualifies as major maintenance or capital?
Correct.
Right, not anything.
Well, yeah, sorry, within that parameter.
Right.
So that's $2.4 million we're adding to the current fiscal year for capital projects.
Correct, yeah. It'll be a set-aside in contingency, but again, designated for infrastructure maintenance and capital.
And then what will our contingency be after we pass everything here today?
In net, we're adding, the 400. We're adding the 465, so it'll be about $1.1 million.
For the current fiscal year?
For the current fiscal year. Correct. That's the unallocated contingency, right? We are also then setting aside the $3.9 million for next year's budget.
Is there any additional council discussion? Anyone wish to testify in this matter?
No one signed up.
Can you please call the vote?
And actually, Mayor, I think because there is something that qualifies as a major supplemental, you just need to open a budget hearing.
Okay.
I should have noted that before.
That's all right. Just let me turn to the right page. I don't have a script.
Yeah,
Oregon state budget law, I hereby open the hearing on the major supplemental budget amendment.
Correct. And now we just need to see if there's testimony and then close the hearing and vote.
Okay. Again, is there any testimony on this matter? Hearing none, I, under state law, close the budget hearing on the major budget supplemental amendment. Now, can you please call the vote?
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
I'm very happy to see the healthy and better than expected ending fund balance. That's very helpful. And as a tribute to our thrifty city employees and to wise budgeting under the mayor's leadership, aye.
Fish?
Andrew, you and your team deserve a lot of credit for the way you've managed this process, and I join with Commissioner Fritz in thanking you for the clarity of the written and oral presentations on this. And I also want to just express my thanks to my colleagues, not only for the $60,000 we restored for one-time funding for aging and disability services that we helped to fund with the county, which is, of course, important funding for older adults, but also for building into the forecast starting in FY 2013-2014 operations, O&M funding for Gateway Green Phase 1, which we think will be a very promising project in the Gateway area and has the strong support of our partners there. So, again, thank you for your good work. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, thanks to everybody for their hard work. Please support it. Aye.
Adams.
Thanks. Aye. 1449 is approved. Can you please read the title for 1467?
Dedicate $285,000 to create a shelter for juvenile human trafficking victims in Portland and to fund two additional sexual abuse victim advocate positions.
Thank you. Commissioner Dan Saltzman and I have some initial comments. Commissioner.
Well, before us today is the request to start funding and operating four possibly up to 8 additional beds for juveniles who are subject to sex trafficking, minor victims of sex trafficking. And I'm really proud to be here today with Mayor Adams to co-sponsor this. Our community has been serving these victims, but these will be the first shelter beds in our city that are specifically dedicated for commercially sexually exploited youth. The funding for the advocates will mean more outreach to victims and getting them the necessary services. And today's action by the council will build on the work that is already underway and sort of gets us to the stage where we have all cylinders clicking. Senator Ron Wyden is leading the effort to bring federal resources to bear in the city of Portland and indeed nationwide. Commissioner Diane McKeel, Multnomah County Commissioner Diane McKeel, has been an early champion of this issue, and she will continue to do so. And next in January, the county will be beginning a John School. Mayor Adams has increased staffing at the Police Bureau to dedicate more officers and investigators to human trafficking. The City Council just a few weeks ago approved a asset forfeiture ordinance that will take any funds or assets from pimps and johns and use those funds to support victim services and shelter services, of which we're acting on today. So this will eventually build, I think, to be a sustainable source of funding for some operations, to which we're jump-starting today. And then I also want to acknowledge the relentless work of the Oregon Department of Human Services, the Portland Police Bureau, Janus Youth Programs, the Sexual Assault Resource Center, Oregonians Against Trafficking Humans, and the Multnomah County Department of Community Justice, who are also working together on this problem. The list continues, as does our work, but today is a big step forward, and to say that Portland does not tolerate sex trafficking of our children. So I'm pleased to co-sponsor this with you, Mayor.
Thank you, and I, too, am pleased to co-sponsor this with Commissioner Saltzman, who's been working on this issue and other human services issues and social services issues for a very long time. Off the top, I also want to recognize Commissioner Diane McKeel as well for the early attention that she paid, coming up, Commissioner, to this issue. Many of you may have seen some of the national coverage about Portland as a hub for human trafficking. This is not the kind of recognition I want for the city I love or for the city that I help lead. Human trafficking, especially juvenile human trafficking, goes against everything the city believes in and stands for, and we must do everything we can now to combat the causes and the symptoms of this problem. Here's just some of the important and brutal facts about that helps to paint the picture of juvenile human trafficking in the city of Portland. Juvenile human trafficking victims are exploited, coerced, physically and sexually assaulted by their pimps and their johns to perform numerous acts. National statistics indicate one of three missing teens who ends up on the street will be lured and forced into prostitution within 48 hours. The Portland Police Bureau reports an average of 5 cases of human trafficking each week, and at least 2 of these victims are juveniles. The City of Portland, the Portland Police Bureau, committed volunteers, faith organizations, nonprofits, community activists have been working hard to combat this issue for a number of years. As Commissioner Saltzman mentioned, we have doubled the size of the human trafficking detail at the Portland Police Bureau, and equally important, are going through an educational and training program for all police officers to recognize the signs, because many of the juvenile victims will not offer up that they are victims of human trafficking, to recognize the signs and be able to ask the right questions about human trafficking. The city, with this financial commitment, will double the size of the outreach workers that Commissioner Saltzman mentioned with SARC, that does an excellent job and performs a service and makes a connection that uniformed police officers just can't do. And Esther's here, and hopefully we will hear from her. Appreciate that. And with our collaboration with Multnomah County and the Advent Conspiracy, which is a group of local churches that encourages giving around the holiday season, increased giving around the holiday season. That, and along with the forfeiture ordinance that Commissioner Saltzman passed through council a couple of weeks ago, will begin to build a sustainable funding source for a continuum of services. I, too, want to thank U.S. Senator Ron Wyden and the delegation for the legislation that he has introduced into Congress, and also want to recognize the federal government for the $500,000 to Multnomah County for the Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children Steering Committee that provides the overall coordination and accountability for this and other efforts. This is a start. It's not a panacea, but it is the first time this state will have secure shelter beds with the services attached to them for juvenile victims of human trafficking. And so I think it's an important day for Portland and for the county, and I'm very pleased to bring it forward, along with Multnomah County Commissioner Diane McHugh. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Mayor and City Councilors. This is indeed an exciting day, and I want to thank all of you for stepping up. Commissioner Saltzman, with your ordinance on forfeiture several weeks ago, and now the dedicated shelter beds. What we have heard consistently throughout this issue is we need safe shelter. That's the biggest missing piece that we need for the victims. And so this is a wonderful first step along that continuum to work on. Along with Senator Wyden's legislation, it will work toward providing that continuum. And so it is a very exciting day. I'm happy to be here on behalf of the county and partnering with the City of Portland and Janus Youth on this project. So I just want to thank all of you for stepping up to this commitment. Thank you.
Thank you. And one of the benefits of having a nonprofit like Janus Youth in the community is that we are able to allocate the money with existing contracts that we have with the county. We're able to get more than the dollar invested in terms of value, because Janus Youth has the economies of scale, the economies of existing facilities. The benefits of existing facilities will provide some resources to upgrade them, but it is a great partnership to have, because they then can also look for federal, state, and other money along with the county and the state to match our dollars and make them go further. And that, for the public listening, that's why it's a range of 4 to 8. It depends somewhat on the nature of the challenges facing the individual that's brought into the shelter. The nature of the challenge then dictates what kind of matching funds might be available.
Thank you.
Thank you. Would everyone else come up? The three right here in the middle row, come on up. Talk a little bit about your thoughts on this. Yeah, come on up. Yep. You're a special guest today. Esther, maybe you'd be willing to start and talk a little about SARC and what you do and what this will allow you to do.
Sure. Hi, my name is Esther Nelson from the Sexual Assault Resource Center, and I'm an advocate and case manager there for sexually exploited youth. And we have a 24-hour hotline where we triage calls from survivors and their families, as well as law enforcement and other social service providers. We have a 30-minute response time to anywhere in the Tri-County area, and we respond to hospitals, law enforcement precincts, out to the scene if law enforcement is present, and we triage the needs of the survivor and then work with them long term. We're a very relational model, and so we believe that relationship is what will sustain someone in cycling through their attempts to leave and eventually leaving the industry. And we value the long term commitment to them over the short term, and I think that's why I'm so thankful that we're coming up with very creative ways to use existing resources and fund more positions, because we believe that long-term commitment to them is what's going to ultimately help them transition out. So thank you.
I think the important point there that I've come to understand is that sometimes there is, what would you call it, there's f- juveniles that come forward. They want to turn away from this life. Sometimes they'll go back, and you stay with them.
Yes.
Your relationship stays with them, and sometimes it takes more than once or twice for them to decide they've had enough of this terrible life.
That's correct. We look at domestic violence statistics where an adult woman who might have more resources and development may attempt to leave an average of 9 times before she's able to exit a relationship that's not safe for her. And if we consider this organized crime as opposed to one abusive person, and we're talking about adolescent development, we know that they are going to need that unconditional care and support in order to make that actual safe transition. That's right.
Could you talk a little bit about, it's an opportunity to introduce Portlanders who are not watching because our video is down, but to introduce to those listening, Janice, your program and how you will approach this.
I'm Dennis Morrow, Executive Director with Janice Youth Programs. And Janice, for people that aren't aware, Janice is one of the largest adolescent service agencies in the state in terms of working with ultra-high-risk or at-risk youth. We serve over 600 teenagers every day, everything from moms with infant children that we work with through our teen parent program. We operate the homeless youth shelters in downtown Portland, part of which the funding comes from the city. We work with girls and boys in long-term residential care. But the primary area that Janice focuses on is the emergency services and shelter, 24-hour safety off of the streets for both runaway and homeless youth. We have a pretty unique perspective because we not only operate programs for those youth in Portland, we also operate the only programs in Southwest Washington. And when we look at the trafficking issue, we've actually seen a regional inflow. We see a number of the girls that have been coming into our Washington State shelters for over a year now. I would say on any given day, we work with 600 kids, but we have almost 200 who are living with us. And the exciting thing for me is this won't have more youth who are living with us, but it will have specialized places for the youth who we know are already there and a safe place to go off of the street for these young women. Personally, I can tell you I've been at Janice since 1980. I've been working with youth in the youth field since the early 70s, or probably mid-70s. I don't think there's been a moment in my career I would be more proud than today. Mm-hmm. And not proud of Janice, but proud of this city and this county and this state, because the complication of setting up services and a service network for these young women is beyond anything I've ever seen. I sit here proud that we can work with the police, that we can work with the city council, that we can work with Multnomah County, that we can work with nonprofit agencies together, that we work with the FBI. We had a young woman recently who came into one of our runaway programs that didn't have any symptoms or signs, but the staff just felt like something was wrong. Talked to her, she didn't admit to that. Police talked to her, she didn't admit to that. And then the next day an FBI agent came and talked to her, and she basically dumped the whole story. So what we're seeing is as we get these systems trained and working together, and they have never, ever worked together the way we're working together now, we're beginning to create miracles, which is just amazing. At the same time, I would say I don't think I've ever been sadder in my whole career, because the stories that you hear of these young women are ones, personally as a professional, I can't not take home. I have a 13-year-old daughter, I have a 14-year-old daughter, and I try to imagine what the picture would be like of them getting picked up in Lloyd Center and ending up in this business. And it's not anything we want to see happen to a child in this city. So I'm proud to be here with you. I'm proud to sit beside folks that are partners in this. As we're speaking today, the county also is completing a planning process, which Janice is facilitating, that by early December, we will have an entire plan for the community representing a continuum of care from the very first moment they touch the system all the way through to long-term aftercare and support for them to become leaders in the community. I believe we'll be the first community in the country that actually doesn't have just a program, but has an entire design for how we work with these young women over time and do a really amazing job. So this is the first step, but it will be a step into a much larger plan that's going to have huge significance for the whole community.
Could I just clarify, make sure I understand? Thank you. That's very helpful. So we're not actually adding any beds, but what we're doing is designating these 4 to 8 to provide wraparound services for this particular group of folks who need it?
Well, here's the unique thing. If you went out and said, let's just set up a shelter, we're talking about $500,000 to $750,000 a year. What Janice has done is collected resources already from federal, county, state, and then some private donations. And we operate the shelter for runaway kids, which is both for girls and boys. Two of the beds in that shelter historically have been contracted to the DHS, state DHS system, specifically to help keep homeless youth out of the downtown core. We've been so successful in doing that over the last year that the beds have gone virtually unutilized. And so DHS, here's the partnership. They came to Janus and said, could we take our beds? And what do we know? Most of these girls are going to be under DHS custody. Could we take our beds? Would you be willing to convert our beds in your shelter specifically for these girls? And that's so we're not adding new beds, but we're taking capacity that hasn't been utilized, and we're beginning to now.
So there's I've come to understand there's folks answer this question, and let me see if I can tease it apart. So there's the actual physical bed, and there's the slot, you know, there's the client slot available in the system. And right now they're not being utilized, and so our resources allows them, partnered with the other resources, allows us to open up the use of beds. We're not paying the full freight, because of the partnerships that exist among the agencies and exist between Janus and government and other nonprofit funders. And as opposed to just warehousing individuals with a literal sort of place in a shelter and a bed, they're getting the services with this program that they otherwise wouldn't get, because the other funding is not, you cannot use the other funding necessarily for the kinds of services that we, our money, is going to allow to be provided.
Well, close.
Okay.
you're accurate statistically. Let me be more specific. We are already seeing these girls in the shelter, but we do not have two things that are essential. One is we don't have staff trained to be able to deal with the challenges that come in. And secondly, equally important, is if we begin to focus more on specifically these girls, there's a security issue that goes up. And the security is not actually as much around the girls as it is around the potential of the pimps coming in and creating mm-hmm. difficulty for us. So actually what your money is doing is two things. It is providing training, one-time money for training all of the staff at the runaway program, Harry's Mother, that works with these youth. We're already connected to SARC, and we'll be actually adding a SARC case advocate who will be specifically assigned to the girls in the shelter, so they will have that person that's always there. Because what do we know? They're going to come back to the shelter a half a dozen times over 2 or 3 years, too. But each time they come back, they'll have a trained staff, and they'll have the same advocate they're connecting with, so we're creating a long-term relationship with them. And we're adding two staff positions. We can run the shelter right now, but we have, for instance, one night staff awake at night. I don't want 3 or 4 girls with pimps with only one night staff awake at night. That's not safe for the staff. So it's not the kid issue. We can supervise them fine, but we have a community security issue. So what your money does is allow just those two positions, which will be a night and a weekend, or a night and a swing shift staff, that will ensure that when the kids are there, we can be able to provide safety from the community, basically, for them. And that's really the issue, is it's got to be not secure in terms of locks. It's got to be secure in terms of them feeling safe. And you're right, your approximately $100,000 actually is buying you the equivalent of a $600,000 program. That's the real truth of the deal.
And that's wonderful. And just one further final clarification. When I think of shelter, it seems like something that folks show up at when it gets dark and leave again in the morning. But you're telling me this is a 24-hour.
Yeah, we have 24-hour supervised care. We will have the SARC advocates. We also have case managers and family therapists, if the girls can go back home, that work with them. They go to school. If they don't go to school, then we have a day program where they're supervised under activities there. So, no, this is the homeless youth shelters. Our emergency shelter there is simply an overnight shelter. That's just getting kids off the street. This is keeping a girl safe so that she can begin to participate in the system. And we're estimating that could be maybe 2 to 4 weeks maximum. It really is not designed as a long-term care. Part of what we'll be looking at with our system design is what's the next level needed that we need to be able to move them to if they need a longer-term safety. But the beauty of it is, again, we anticipate we'll see them this year, we'll probably see them next month, we'll see them 6 months from now, and we might see them a year from now. But what we know is if you're there, eventually they stick. Dennis, but what they have to know is they have to have a place that they can stick. The police have to have a place they can take the girls to. We have the 24-hour reception center, which actually is the police drop-off point right now. So we already have an existing, and that's awake staffed, separate from the shelter. So the police, if you want to see how this works, police pick up a girl, they bring her to the, we call it the reception center. We have staff there who can immediately connect with SARC, and one phone call, and we can get SARC police and an FBI agent just like that. And we've created what I call a SWAT team that basically is going to surround the girls and start providing immediate support for the community. But now we can say also, and while you're working on this for the next couple of weeks, guess what? We've got a safe place for you, and you'll be with other kids. You're not criminalized, you're not demonized, you're a victim, and that's how you're going to be seen.
Wonderful.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Nick.
So I'm going to enthusiastically support this request, but I have a couple of questions just based on what you said. So the city now spends just under $1 million funding the shelters with the county funding shelter beds for minors. And I think there's at least three nonprofits that are benefited, your organization, New Avenue for Youth, and Outside In. So we have a lot of experience with that relationship and then also looking at outcomes and evaluating. I guess I'm a little less clear as to how we evaluate this program. So my two questions are, how many minors do you think you'll see in the course of a calendar and of a 12-month period? And who is actually tracking outcomes and keeping an eye on the public investment to make sure we're getting a return?
Well, I'm going to answer that last part first. Mm-hmm. Part of the reason that, we are building our response to this as we go. I'm the first to say that up front. But we are benefited in answering your very good question by the fact that we do have this federal grant of $500,000 that Multnomah County, therefore, has put together the multi-agency task force called the Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children Steering Committee, CSEC. And they are coming up with, in addition to working with everyone to come up with the strategy, which will be in a matter of weeks, not years or months, also coming up with the accountability metrics. And we will fine-tune then as we go. We thought it was important, though, to get the services out there as quickly as possible, to get the secure beds out there as quickly as possible. But if this is too much money, then we will be coming back with the any sort of changes. I doubt it will be. But that is, I think, that's only an answer to part of the question, if you could answer the first part.
Sure. And again, a portion of the money is one-time only funds, and that is for some minor upgrades in the building, but primarily it's for security functions. We've had the police come out and look at the building with us, and we're looking at where we put security cameras. That stuff is one time. Then we're back to an ongoing number, which is lower than that even. The issue of how many youth are out there, that's...
Minors do you expect to serve in the first year?
Don't have a clue. And the reason is because we know that there is somewhere between 100 to 300 girls who may be in the system somewhere, but because there are no services, they have never been brought forward. The police oftentimes aren't able to get them into services. They don't volunteer into services. So I'm not being flippant with I don't have a clue. Janice, we have the contract with the county to lead the planning process for this group. And one of the issues has been, what is the number? And there's lots of numbers flying around. The number that the planning group has settled on is about 125 to 150 girls at any one time that we're looking at services for. Today is actually the meeting where they're trying to go back and say, how many of those do we think will be in shelter? How many of them will be in long-term living situations? How many of them may actually go into the downtown homeless youth system where you have some pre-funded services for long-term transitional living services? That's what we're trying to come up with at this point. But my gut would tell me that if you're looking at utilization of these beds, probably 2 to 4 at any given time to start with, because, again, once we get the other services downstream, we don't want them too long in the shelter. We just want them safe while they're there. Our metric in terms of what we look at in terms of outcomes is safe exits. That's what we're measured by. The federal grant that we have requires over a 90% safe exit from the shelter, which means when a youth goes somewhere, they're going someplace better than when they came in. I don't think we're going to hit 90% with these girls because they exit themselves. But the way that we are going to deal with the issue of the tracking, just like you have with the homeless youth system downtown, that's actually the model we're using for how we're going to construct this system for sexually trafficked girls. So what that means is whatever agencies are going to be a part of the funding and a part of the service delivery, we're going to create a single integrated data system, just like we have for the homeless youth system downtown. And I think you're familiar with that data. We can punch up on any given year how many youth came in, how many services they got, how many exited each element of service, where we were successful, where we weren't, and because we have a central release form, all of the agencies report all of the kids, and we can then do joint case management, which is the same thing we have to do here. So we will be setting up, as part of the system, actually that same type of a data tracking that will give us outcomes on a case-by-case and also outcomes on a system basis.
I guess, Dennis, just in light of that, and thank you for a very clear
explanation of the whole thing. Can you guesstimate how many young people are currently in our homeless continuum that otherwise would qualify under this program, who may have either not disclosed that they are victims of sexual trafficking or have had some, you know, history or are at risk?
The answer, the professional answer at this point is we believe very few. But the other side of the answer, and we've seen this in our Washington State programs, is part of the reason is because nobody is talking about it, but the staff haven't been trained to ask the right questions. And as we have trained our staff on the Washington State side, we found more girls than we ever knew were there because they're now screened and seen differently. And I think, but when I say very few, what we're seeing is that most of the youth in the homeless youth system, they oftentimes engage in survival sex, but they're not part of an organized pimp or an organized sexually trafficked ring the same way these girls are. The other reason is, frankly, the target group we're talking about here is 12 to 17. Over 90% of the youth in the homeless youth system now are 17 and over. We are predominantly dealing with the 17 to 23 or 24-year-old group of homeless youth downtown because the younger kids are getting diverted into more appropriate systems. That was one of the issues with DHS. Their kids were ending up in the wrong place. They were in our homeless youth system. They shouldn't be there. So that's how we set up the relationship with them. So we've been very successful at getting younger kids out. When you take the younger kids out, this population then disappears out of it. We do think some of those resources, as you get into the 16, 17, 18-year-old young woman who's going to maybe does not have a family to go back to, we think we're going to be able to work with the homeless youth system and take some of the capacity there and convert it, just like we've done with the shelter. So you have an existing capacity you can convert instead of starting new. And that really is what we're trying to do. Wherever we can, these programs are extremely expensive to operate. So if we can take current capacity and train people up to it, then we're going to have a much more efficient use of whatever resources we put into it. So that was actually, we started out thinking there would be large numbers of the girls in the system downtown, but the biggest piece was the age range. If you look at our data, it's been very clear, and each year in the homeless youth system, that age has gone up. So we have very few of these kids. This will be 12 to 17, and really our target group for the shelter is probably mostly going to be 12 to 15. You're talking about little girls on the street who need a safe place.
I think it's also interesting, and Esther, maybe you could give us your perspective on the commissioner's question on numbers. I also think it's very interesting that over the past couple of months that we've been working on this is, you know, the training. You talked about training, and I mentioned it briefly, but an example of how better training of our police officers mm-hmm. Will make the invisible but existing more visible is our office, you know, the vulnerability, you mentioned it, of runaways being vulnerable to this kind of challenge is the vulnerability is very high. But our officers haven't necessarily been trained after asking, are you a runaway, are you truant, whatever, of necessarily asking other kinds of questions that would there go on and find a deeper and more accurate understanding of the truth in terms of exploitation. Can you talk a little bit about the numbers from your point of view and the need?
Sure. I would agree that we don't know exactly, and if we're looking at numbers, I think that's an accurate answer right now. In terms of SARC's capacity and what we've served since we started serving this population, we have about 150 people on our caseload right now. But we also don't close cases because we believe in that long-term commitment. So I wouldn't say that we've served 150 just this year. I would say that it's probably been about 2 years now that we've been serving about 150 people total. That means that there are two case managers, so about 75 people are on each of our caseloads. And at any given time, I would say about 20 of those on my caseload are needing real high-level crisis intervention type needs, and then the rest of them are in some sort of flux, whether it be on the run, in a different state needing services, or in some sort of secure environment. So we see a lot, a very broad range of their needs, just depending on where they're at in that continuum of trying to exit the life or the sex industry. And we will serve them on any end of that continuum. So about 150 people total that SARC has served as an agency. We also do what we call warm handoffs, so very supportive handoffs to other agencies around the country because they're very much in flux in terms of where they're at. So we work with people all over the country who either came from Portland and are now elsewhere, or they're coming from somewhere else in the country and they're trying to get to Portland, usually for safety reasons.
Well, I'll probably also add that the SARC advocates are located at the Gateway Center for Domestic Violence Services.
Yes, I would love to highlight that, actually. I'm glad you brought that up. So we're currently, fortunately, located at the Gateway One-Stop Domestic Violence Resource Center. It's a great, I think, open door to services because their experiences with their PIMP are domestic violence. They also have a broad range of other traumas that they experience, but I think that the domestic violence model is so useful for them. So even though we serve predominantly minors, that's a great access point for them as well. There's a lot of other services there that apply to them, not just SARC advocacy.
All right, thank you very much. Oh, yes.
Yes, my name's Sarah Hobbs, and I'm here today. I volunteer with Stop Child Trafficking. Now, I'm angry, and I just want to say thank you for what you're doing. I am angry that my city gets listed in a damn rather report labeled Pornland. I am angry. I have been very fortunate to have been mentored in the issue of human trafficking by Colonel Bill Hiller. Colonel Hiller lost his daughter to sex trafficking. It was his story that inspired the 2008 movie with Liam Neeson, Taken. I have been blessed to really be mentored by probably one of the best on the issue in the country. And I am grateful for what you're doing, but I'm going to encourage you, stay the course. I have had things thrown at me from people I never thought I'd get. And it's a difficult issue. I've been dealing with a lot of apathy in this city. You know, if one more person tells me it's just a third world country, they will hear me screaming in a third world country. I mean, so while personally, and I'm just going to be honest and admit, I feel what's being done is a small, very small step. I want to thank you for taking the small step. I respect that we have to start somewhere for the sake of our children. This is our next generation. I was talking to somebody, I have a concern. If these children are victimized and not helped, just out of their confusion, we run the risk of having a whole nother generation of victimizers. So I am very grateful. I can relate to what the gentleman from Gina said. I take the stories I hear with my work with SCT now and the discussions I have with Colonel Hiller home with me. I look forward to the day when I don't hear them, when our children are safe. And I'm sorry, I love you guys, but I want to put you out of a job. So thank you.
Well said.
And also, I was very excited, Mayor Adams, as a SCT now volunteer, to see our banner out front. And I asked everybody, who do I thank for that? And they told me to thank you. So thank you.
Thank you for everything that you do. Yes, sir.
Just one final point I want to make, and that is, and you triggered it when you said that this needs to be a long-term commitment, not to Janice, but to these girls. My personal experience, and I shared this with Diane McKeel when the county adopted their resolution, I sat on a task force in 1983 and worked with a group of community agencies that put together a program to attack juvenile prostitution in downtown Portland. We got a federal grant that lasted 2 years, and for 2 years we had a model of services in this county. And guess what? When the federal grant went away, the services went away because it's not an easy issue to keep visible exactly. Publicly. And I'll tell you right now, I would rather not open these beds than open these beds and close them in a year.
Yes.
Because these girls have been victimized enough. And once we make a commitment, and I'm not saying a commitment to Janice, but I'm saying as a community, we have to institutionalize this, and our model, again, is the homeless youth system. 10 years ago, we put together a system of services with the city and the county. It's now a national model and does more and better work with those kids than any place in the whole country, literally. We need to have that same level of institutional commitment. So I look at this as a down payment, not in terms of the amount of money, but whatever we put in, we've got to be willing to hold until we don't need it anymore. And I'm hoping we get there, but until then, we can't back out on this a second time.
Well said, all of you. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Is anyone else signed up?
No one else signed up.
Does anyone else wish to testify in this matter? Okay. Detective, do you want to come up as well? Just say a few words. Yeah, come on up.
Just go sit down.
Just go ahead and sit down, Veronica. Yeah.
Good morning, Mira.
How are you? I haven't seen you for a while.
Well, I know I've been away, but I've been busy. I'll just sit real quickly here. Good morning, Commissioner.
Fritz, good morning, Randy Leonards, and good morning, Dan Saltzman, and good morning, Nick Fish, wherever you are. Big howdy. Trying to focus on the Western influence here this morning. Traveling is important. I know that our current mayor, I'm from PSU, I'm an alumni of 2005, and I majored in public health and community health education at Portland State. It's a wonderful state college, and it's very expansive, and it's in a renaissance period. It's growing by leaps and bounds. You can't understand how big they're getting until you walk across the campus, and it's growing, definitely. But traveling and trafficking are two adverbial adjectives that have to do with movement from one place to another. And I understand, as mayor, you are the commissioner of transportation. I would like to just reflect for just a minute where transportation comes in. My nonprofit, Women's Affordable Housing Forum, does dovetail with transportation and many different issues. There are ways to pick up domestic violence survivors at a bus stop, at the Safeway, at a local place. I understand SARC and what they stand for, and I definitely am against what they stand for. I think this is important. However, there's one more thing I would like to add, and at this point in time, I think there needs to be a safe way for them to get from point A to point B, whether it's California or Seattle or Washington, or across the board throughout the United States. That 1-800-DV number is so important. And as these children go through your lifespan, imagine your 13-year-old. I don't have a 13-year-old right now, but imagine your 13-year-old girl is standing on a corner running away from home because both parents are chemically dependent and she's fleeing domestic violence, and she doesn't feel like she's at fault, but she has to escape. And as she takes that first step towards her freedom, does she not look at the city at large and the state at large and the entire United States and think, where am I going to go to get out of this one? Chemical dependency is such a big deal in our country, and it's driving our teens away from their homes. And I just wanted to bring this up at this point in time, that whatever you're doing, whether you have a SWAT team, SWAT, I don't know what the acronym stands for. I would probably say sexual, I don't know what the W stands for. In French, it's Stubblebe, but in Italian, it's another number. But SWAT, when I think of SWAT, of course, I think of policing, and I think that's important. It's tempting to police the problem off, but there is a tender side. When we were a kinder and gentler nation, according to former President George Bush, there was another way to do it. And I just wanted to bring that up. Thank you.
Thank you, Veronica. I wanted to take the opportunity to, I didn't see you back there. Do you want to briefly come up and explain the work that you're doing in the police bureau?
Excuse me. Hi, I'm Sergeant Michael Geiger, and I supervise Portland.
Can you get this for Mike?
I'll be close. Yeah. Sorry about that. And I supervise the Detective Division Sex Crimes and Human Trafficking Unit. What I think is so amazing, and I want to thank the mayor and city council, as well as Commissioner McKeel, because I think for the first time ever, since we've been dealing with this unit, we feel supported, and we feel like there is actually a positive outcome that can occur. What we've been faced with historically is a population that we couldn't identify, we couldn't track, and we had no relationships in place that were the kind that would adequately deal with this. And one of the first things that we began trying to do is identify exactly who this population is. What are our numbers? What are we faced with here so that we would know how to devote resources to? So we began that approach by partnering with DHS Child Welfare. And what we came to realize is that there is this huge population out there that we were completely unaware of because we didn't have the kind of dialogue that was necessary to even identify these youth. The other thing that happened is it was the old story. What do we do with this child at 2 o'clock in the morning? You know, where were we supposed to take her? How are we supposed to keep her out of the life? When one of the things that we came to know is that not only are they our evidence, but that our evidence runs away. Because there aren't the kind of support services after we pick them up that can care for them in the way that they need to be cared for. So what we began doing is trying to recognize both what the problem was and how are we going to address it. And one thing that is completely clear is that the police bureau by itself, the sexual assault unit, the detective division, cannot handle this by ourselves. And so by developing the kind of relationships that are meaningful, we've partnered with the Sexual Assault Resource Center. We work so closely with them, not just on trafficking issues, but on sexual assault cases as well. By partnering with DHS Child Welfare and also with Harry's mother in the Juvenile Reception Center, I'm getting to know their staff, and we understand that by working with them, when it comes time for us to pass this child off to somebody else, we are confident that the group that they're being handled off to is trained and is appropriate to deal with this. So one of the things we know is that these girls need long-term care, and they need the kind of care that police officers by themselves can't adequately deal with. They need trained advocates, very specifically trained advocate, and they need the kind of shelter that is specific to their needs because it's a population that has been abused horribly. They have been controlled, and their children. And I'm just grateful that we've come together so that we can bring a different message to these children, because what they keep hearing from their traffickers is that they can't trust anybody. And I think we now know that that's not true.
Well, you're doing absolutely fantastic work, you and your team, and I want to thank you for that.
Okay.
All right. Anyone else wish to testify? Carla, can you please call the vote?
Leonard?
Well, interestingly, as I was listening to the excellent testimony, the only thing that I was sitting here wishing was happening was that a representative of the police bureau was here. And I'm sorry, Sergeant Geiger, I didn't recognize you, but I was really happy you came up and testified, because I was going to observe this was an excellent presentation, but for the police bureau not being present. You're present, and it's great. And the reason I say that is because I think in the last few years, we have seen really a transformation in how the police bureau identifies issues that previously have been identified as strictly law enforcement issues, whether it's drug abuse, drug selling, alcoholism. The police bureau has to be an important partner with the folks that are here. It is Mayor Adams, as he correctly said in his remarks earlier, that officers oftentimes encounter these victims and don't even know what to ask. And so it's important to me that not only do we provide the services that Commissioner Saltzman has advocated for and Commissioner McKeel has advocated for and that the mayor advocates for, but that the police bureau recognizes this as part of a solution and not just a law enforcement issue when they deal with prostitution and pimps, but there are underlying motivations and factors that can be resolved with the right resources. And Sergeant Geiger, you identified that perfectly for me, and I really appreciated everybody's testimony, but I was really glad that the police bureau gets that and makes that connection. So I'm just very proud of this effort and others like it, where and the police bureau just does not get enough acknowledgement publicly under the leadership of this chief, Mike Reese, in problem solving on a variety of levels in a way that has brought us not just national but even international attention. I think Portland's in a leader in how it approaches problem solving as opposed to law enforcement, and this is another aspect of it that I'm very pleased to support.
Fritz.
Thank you, Mayor Adams, Commissioner Saltzman, and Commissioner McKeel, for your leadership on this issue and for everybody who's here today and everybody who you're connected with. This is a community effort. This is a series of partnerships, and that's why it's going to work, and that's why it's going to be a first step. It's going to be a long journey, and we're going to get there. I'm the commissioner in charge of the Office of Human Relations, and the Human Rights Commission is very concerned about this. And some, both on the Human Rights Commission and in the community, are rightly concerned that we are all become aware that human trafficking is more than prostitution. There's various forms of slavery, including domestic servitude, forced farm labor abuses, and other kinds of human trafficking. As you so eloquently said, we have to start somewhere. When we did the forfeiture resolution a couple of weeks ago, we had two men who came in and said that prostitution is something that happens between two consenting adults and that the government should stay out of it. So we have a long way to go. And I hope that at least we can agree as a community that prostitution, when it affects children under the age of 18, is wrong, and that those children are victims, that it is not something that they have a choice about, and that we as a community are doing something about that. And as I say, that will be the first step, because I think the more we understand and know about this, thanks to the work that's been going on in the community and is now coming to attention thanks to the leadership of Commissioner McKeel, Commissioner Saltzman, and Mayor Adams, we are going to do more about it. And this money that's being appropriated today is from the contingency, and there's no more urgent need right now today than to immediately put it to this use. And I commend Mayor Adams, Commissioner Saltzman, for figuring out this step in partnership with the community, and we will do more. We have to do more. Aye.
Fish?
Well, I also want to thank Commissioner McKeel, Mayor Adams, and Commissioner Saltzman for their leadership on this question and for putting it at the top of our respective agendas for action. I'm in charge of providing housing for people in our community. And it is not a criticism directed to me or to my outstanding team that too many people are still falling between the cracks, and that there are too many people that don't have a safe and decent place to call home. What this discussion, though, does, I think, that's useful for the public is it gives us a context to talk about Resolution A and what it means today, not what it means years ago when it was adopted. And for those who don't know what Resolution A is, that was an agreement, which is now very dated, where the city and county divided up some responsibilities. One of the responsibilities that went to the county was funding responsibility for victims of domestic violence. We retained responsibility for adult homeless. The county is primarily responsible for children and families. What I have come to appreciate in working with the heroes in our movement, and there's none better than Janice and Dennis and the team that's one of the lead agencies that takes the money we appropriate and the county appropriates to deal with homeless youth and to operate community gardens and do many other things, is that we don't have the money to meet the needs, and the old division of labor is meaningless. If you are vulnerable and in need of services in our community, I think you could care less whether the county or the city provides the service. But the reality is, we are providing duplicative services or inefficiently delivering services because we still maintain two different systems. And as I sit through these forums where we have these really powerful presentations on another part of our system that we're not meeting the needs, and I think about what it takes, what it will take in terms of government support to get to where we want to go, I would say that it in my mind, means that we have to have even more focus on looking at the Resolution A issues of who does what and how we fund them, because one thing is for sure, the current model is not sustainable, and with the kinds of cuts coming down the pike, there's no way the county can continue to meet its service obligations, its obligations to provide the services to whatever housing the city provides. So in addition to the great work of my colleagues in bringing this to public attention and coming up with an innovative way to begin to address this need, I would want to put a marker down that long-term we're going to have to figure out how to fund all of these very important programs. And we do not have a sustainable model to do that. And at the core of it is, I think, that the Resolution A division of labor no longer makes any sense. So at budget time, we'll have a chance to talk about that more robustly. And in the work that we're doing with Diane and Commissioner Kefouri and Chair Kogan, we're looking at some of these Resolution A issues. But I don't want people to think that we can meet the marker that Dennis put down about continuing to invest and building on this system without a very frank conversation about where the money's going to come from and how we're going to fund it. So, again, to my colleagues, the mayor, Commissioner Saltzman, and Commissioner McHale, thank you for your leadership. And to everyone who testified, thank you for your inspiring words. Aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I think we're making progress. I think one of the things we're doing